The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, an Apple Premier partner. TechServe has been supporting New Yorkers for 29 years with Mac repairs and upgrades, including data recovery, liquid damage, hard drive issues, general troubleshooting, and more. TechServe.com. And An American in Paris, the new Tony Award-winning musical that brings the magic and romance of Paris into perfect harmony with the unforgettable songs of George and Ira Gershwin, winner of more awards than any other musical of the year. Tickets at AmericanInParisBroadway.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Thanks so much for listening. We begin this hour with a look at a national public health problem that has spared no community in America: the availability of opioid narcotics by prescription that leads to addiction to heroin, which is more available on the street than ever. Here's a comment from one of you in Portland, Oregon. I lost my brother in 2007. Now I care for my grandchild as my own child struggles with addiction. Heroin is hell. Or this from Sandy Hook, Connecticut. It has taken my 21-year-old son from being a promising athlete to living in homeless shelters.
My name is Ava. I'm calling from Canton, Massachusetts. I was influenced or impacted by heroin 3 years ago this last Friday. My fiancé, Michael, passed away from a heroin overdose, something he'd been struggling with, trying to find help for. And when he did call a rehab, he called over and over and over, being told the same thing: call back, we don't have a bed. And then when he finally did find a place that had a bed, he was told that he could not be admitted into the rehab because he had no longer had heroin in his system. He died about 5 days after that last phone call.
This is Diane from Cape Cod. Former students from every high school class for the last 10 years are dead from overdoses, and so many others are in jail for drug-related crimes. It is devastating.
From Albany, Oregon, it killed the man I wanted to marry and grow old with. Lynn, Massachusetts. I grew up in Lynnfield, Mass., a town of maybe 9,000, and by the time I was 16, I had three friends die opioid-related deaths. I'm now 26 and have yet to go a full year without someone I knew or I know dying from it. And here's a comment from East Merrimack, New Hampshire. I've lost too many peers to this crisis. You can't walk down the streets without addicts begging. Home and car break-ins are the norm now, not the exception. It is so sad, and it seems there's a lot of talking, but no action. There's been a lot of talking about a lot of issues all across New Hampshire, besides East Merrimack. Today is primary day, of course, in the Granite State, but the people who will be voting for presidential candidates today largely have a local issue on their mind. Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick has been in New Hampshire, seeing just how the local issue of heroin addiction has intruded on a confused field of candidates and national political messages.
Everywhere I go to campaign, I'm meeting families who are affected by the drug problem.
The one that surprised me at the early part of my journey was the epidemic of heroin.
My older sister, Miriam, struggled her whole life with drug and alcohol addiction.
It is a tragedy for New Hampshire. It is a tragedy for my state of Vermont. It is a tragedy all over this country.
Morning.
Morning. How are you?
Great, Zach. How are you?
Good.
On Sunday morning, 2 days before the New Hampshire primary, I meet up with 29-year-old Zach Brewster in the parking lot of his church, the First Assembly of God in Auburn, just outside Manchester.
Thanks for meeting me.
Yeah, pleasure. I forgot that Ted Cruz, I think, is going to be here today.
More on Ted Cruz in just a minute. We head on in, and on the way, we run into Zach's boss from the Teen Challenge Christian Drug Rehabilitation Program, where he works.
What's up, Aaron?
What's up, buddy?
This is my boss.
No, he listens to me half the time.
Inside, we're surrounded by people who Zach knows. The church is a big part of his life. He credits his religious faith for his recovery from heroin. It's a tight-knit group. During the service, two young addicts, they call them students, from Teen Challenge give testimony. Then they strip down and are baptized in a pool built right into the stage. Heroin isn't new in New Hampshire, but its impact now is unprecedented. Nearly 400 fatal overdoses from heroin and other opiates like prescription fentanyl in 2015. And that says nothing about the other costs like medical, incarceration, lost work. While we're waiting for things to get going, I ask Zach what the epidemic looks like from street level.
The bottom line is that the heroin is better. you know, it's better quality. And the fentanyl, yeah, it is a part of it, but it's cheap now. It's cheaper than a pack of cigarettes. It's easier to find than weed. You know, as far as all the overdoses and stuff, just been a lot more potent over the last 5 years.
Back to Ted Cruz now, who was indeed at the service. New Hampshire's opiate epidemic has forced presidential candidates to talk about addiction during the campaign. Some have offered specific policies. Others have offered empathy. Earlier, you heard how Ted Cruz told a debate audience about his half-sister, who died of an overdose. On this morning, Cruz talks about his parents' religious conversion.
I was born as a small child that lived up in Canada. You may have heard that. And when I was a little boy, my parents were not Christians. And both of them were drinking far too much.
They do a little politics on this morning, too. It is the season, after all. Here's Pastor Gary Hamilton.
When I vote for him on Tuesday, I'm not voting just for Senator Cruz. I'm voting for the kingdom of God.
It's fair to say Zach is a big believer in the kingdom of God part. As to whether Ted Cruz represents it, well, Zach's not super into politics. He is, however, into sharing the full, unedited story of his addiction, and he was into it before the national media descended on New Hampshire. In the car riding back to his parents' house, Zach talks about how he was using drugs by age 12, buying cocaine at 17, hooked on heroin at 20, multiple arrests, a couple of felonies knocked down to misdemeanors, 7 months in jail, not to mention a near-death overdose.
We've had a lot of people that we know die from heroin overdoses that were either students in the program or family members of people in the program, so family members of staff. So it's been tough.
Remember Zach's boss, Aaron, the one who said hi to us in the church parking lot before? Zach says just 2 weeks ago, his wife died from an overdose. Aaron was at work the next day.
Oh, great. Hi, nice to meet you. I'm Joanne.
Nice to meet you, too. Thank you for having me.
Oh, you're welcome. More than welcome. Come on in. Had a nice write-up. At least it's nice and sunny. That's what I heard. Pretty exciting.
Zach's parents are Bill and Joanne Brewster. They're into politics, but typical New Hampshire, not terribly interested in promises and definitely not help from politicians. Bill and Joanne are both medical professionals. He's a doctor and a top executive at New Hampshire's largest insurance company. She's a nurse, and as sophisticated and as connected as they are, they had a nightmare getting their insurance company, who they worked for at the time, to cover Zach's rehab. It wound up costing tens of thousands of dollars. Here's Bill.
You don't get a whole lot of support. If you say, look, I'm really fighting to get my heroin-addicted child help, people go, oh, yeah, okay. If you say, I'm really fighting with this payer to get coverage for cancer therapy, people would think, you know, they'd back you up. Well, call my friend who's a senator.
The Brewsters eventually won an appeal against the insurance company, but money is only a small part of it. Again, the Brewsters don't think any of the candidates in New Hampshire right now are going to grind out a policy that makes the opiate problem go away. They're more about the attention they can shine on it. And to that end, the candidates at least talking about it is just fine. Here's Joanne.
I think years ago, probably candidates would have never mentioned that because that would have been a really black mark on them. But today, it is coming out and people are accepting it and realizing that, hey, it's just not that poor homeless kid on the street. These are people it's dealing in all of our lives.
Of course, there's a risk that when the party is over tomorrow, when everyone is packed up and moved on to Nevada and South Carolina, that New Hampshire and its opiate problem will be forgotten by the candidates and by the national media.
These kinds of discussions, what will continue to happen after the politicians are gone, hopefully we've infected them with a little bit of they got to think about it, if not just in their own life even. And that, you know, with politicians actually talking almost like they're bragging and making other people feel comfortable that, you know what, it's not me. There is hope. Mm-hmm. And these are just people. These are somebody's kids.
Back in the car, Zach also worries about the political show moving on.
It's a tough thing. Yeah, when everybody goes away, what's going to happen? Who knows? You know, I would like to hope that the attention will carry, you know, to the next states and the next states, and more people will start to pay a little bit more attention to it.
In the meantime, Zach says he's gearing up for a transfer to full-time college classes. He's gunning for medical school and possibly psychiatry. He says that even though he's very religious, he believes in what he calls the secular world of medicine and in the power of hardcore behavioral therapy. His main mission, he says, is to be a success and never be far from home, so that long after the attention is gone, addicted people can look at him and see that there is real recovery and real hope. I'm Todd Zwillick in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, for The Takeaway.
This is Kelly from Oviedo, Florida. My older brother has used heroin on and off for years. He has a chronic pain issue from an old accident, and when the oxycodone is gone, heroin is his next best thing. He has lost a marriage, a house, and had many friends die from the use of heroin. He has cheated our mother, stolen, and lied to get money for the drug.
Official statistics say 500,000 people reported using heroin in 2013, but the real number is likely far higher. Do you know one of those people? Charlotte, North Carolina. I'm a recovering heroin addict. I've been clean for 11 months, but it's still difficult. I saw my childhood friends ruining their lives, saw several good people die. It's terrible, but that's what it took for me to take the initiative to get clean. I moved to the other side of the country, away from my friends, family, and girlfriend. It was the hardest thing I've ever done, but I know it was worth it, and I wouldn't wish heroin withdrawals on my worst enemy.
My name is Mia. I was born and raised in the Bay Area. Heroin entered my community in 2007 when I left for college. I was so surprised. Drugs had always been around, but nothing that serious. Before, I'd only seen heroin in rock and roll movies. I spent the next year trying to help friends stop using. Looking back on it, I blame it on the popularity of OxyContin years prior. I had to leave those friends behind because it was too emotionally draining and heartbreaking to watch. College provided an escape for me that they never got or pursued. I'm not even sure if they're still alive or what happened to them.
McKinney, Texas. I lost a cousin to overdose and several friends are recovering addicts. I know for sure that at least one started with prescriptions, and when she couldn't get those anymore, she switched to needles. It is terrifying and heartbreaking.
Hi, my name is Debbie. I'm calling from Portland, Oregon. My beautiful niece, Christine, died just over 2 years ago of a heroin overdose. She was 21 years old. She really, really, really wanted to get well. She needed long-term treatment and care that was simply unavailable to her, and I miss her very much every day.
Burlington, Vermont. A large amount of fentanyl-laced heroin made its way into our state in 2015 and killed several people from my high school. I'm 26 years old, and I've lost more high school friends and acquaintances from heroin than from any other cause of death. I just hope it stops.
This is Emily from Portland, Oregon. My brother started using heroin when he was 16 in the late 1990s. I was only 7 or 8 at the time. He was one of the most academically brilliant people you'll ever meet. He's also incredibly witty and likable. But heroin and addiction have led to manipulation and delusion over the years. He was in prison for about 12 years and released on parole for a year before he lost control of his emotions and life again, where he turned back to heroin. He took a gun and robbed a small business. He's currently waiting trial to see if the state will give him a mandated program or send him back to prison. It's the saddest thing I'll ever have to deal with, to think I'll never have the brother I was supposed to have. Heroin robs you of your loved ones, and chances are you'll never get them back.
Where will this issue be in the 2016 election? Thank you all for sharing your personal stories. Keep them coming, though. 877-8-MY-TAKE is our number, and you can always comment at thetakeaway.org. In the nation of Libya, the end of decades of dictatorship under Muammar Gaddafi came to a noisy, swift end in October of 2011. Libyans celebrating in the streets of Sirte after the death of Muammar Gaddafi and shouting in the middle of it all, wearing a Yankees baseball cap and waving the golden revolver of Colonel Gaddafi, was a young man named Mohammed al-Bibi. The image of al-Bibi became the symbol of all the contradictions and promise of the Arab Spring and the Libyan Revolution. Gabriel Gatehouse, foreign correspondent for BBC News, was at the scene of Gaddafi's death in 2011. He returned to Libya to explore the country's very chaotic present. Gabriel, what do you think the significance is of this golden revolver?
I was in Libya, in Sirte, the place where Colonel Gaddafi was caught and killed on that day. And the fighters were brandishing it around. They were passing it between each other like a sort of, not only a totem of their victory, but it also seemed to be a symbol of the transfer of power in the new Libya. So as such, what I wanted to know was what's happened to it now, now that the country has basically disintegrated into warring factions. We've got so-called Islamic State taking over in Gaddafi's hometown of Sirte. As a symbol of that transfer of power, where is it now? Who has it now? And what does it mean to those people who were so full of hope back then?
And you really describe a story of chaos, of the breaking down of any sort of civil order. Anwar Suwan, who is in Misrata, spoke with you and was very close to Gaddafi's body after his death and is completely hopeless now.
Everyone has demands. All the parties are fighting each other. They cut off the head of the snake, Gaddafi, and now there are hundreds of snakes in his place.
Is he wishing for the days of Gaddafi?
No, he's not. He most definitely isn't. Although I think there are some who are. I mean, the breakdown of law and order is kind of selective in Libya. What it is more is the breakdown of Libya as a country. Misrata itself basically is quite safe. It rules itself as a kind of mini city state. And that seems to be increasingly the direction of travel in Libya. All these various different militias who are fiercely loyal to, you could call it tribe, you could call it geographical location. Sometimes it's got more to do with ideology. They are increasingly running their own little fiefdom. So what you get is pockets of security, but between them, a lot of insecurity. And that's the vacuum that Islamic State is exploiting.
Tell us about this pocket of insecurity at Leptis Magna, which is a Roman ruin in North Africa and is being guarded by people who really believe that they're on their own.
Yeah, this extraordinary guy, Ali Hribish, he must have been in his 60s at least, possibly in his 70s, an old man with a Kalashnikov standing guard amidst these incredible ruins. They are some of the best bits of Roman architecture anywhere in North Africa. And these guys, him and just a handful of friends, basically, have taken it upon themselves as volunteers to stand guard against anyone, really. But obviously, their biggest fear is Islamic State.
We will protect it ourselves. There is no help. There is no government. We will die if that's what it takes to stop them taking this place.
If they got to Leptis Magna, I think it's fair to assume that the fate of those amazing columns and amphitheatres would be similar to that of the Roman ruins at Palmyra in Syria, which we saw being dynamited not so long ago. But they are begging for help from anyone, from any of the various authorities, governments that run Libya, from the international community, and so far they're not seeing anything.
Do they believe that airstrikes and the help that they've gotten up until now is sufficient?
Well, at the moment, there's a big debate going on, not just inside Libya, but also in the United States and in other European capitals about what is the best way to tackle Islamic State. An opinion on the ground is divided on that. Libyans are fiercely proud of their country. They don't like the idea of foreign intervention, but many people acknowledge that they cannot take on Islamic State on their own, especially divided as they are. So the question is, what does the West do about this? And what we've seen is the Pentagon and others quietly sending in small groups of special forces to go and suss out on the ground who among the armed factions might be good partners to partner up with. And I think at the moment they don't quite have the answer.
And what of this curious totem, the gun itself, which you actually came upon and found and you see where it is today?
Yeah, so interestingly enough, the gun today is still with the same kid. He was 17 years old at the time, who I saw waving it above his head as he was being carried on the shoulders of his comrades on the 20th of October 2011, the day that they captured and killed Gaddafi. I found this guy, Mohammed. He still has the pistol. And I said, how did you Why were you the hero? He seemed to be the hero. Everyone was cheering him on. And he said it was a misunderstanding. He didn't capture Gaddafi. He didn't take part in his killing. Simply, amid the confusion, he'd simply found the gun lying on the ground somewhere between Gaddafi's bombed-out convoy, it'd been hit by a French airstrike, and the sewage pipe, the drainage pipe that Gaddafi'd been hiding in. He found the gun on the floor. He picked it up. He started waving it around. All his fellow rebels thought, that's Gaddafi's golden gun. He must have been the guy who captured him. So he became the accidental hero of the revolution. But there's a darker side to this. He is fearful of what possession of that gun means. He says he's still got threats from pro-Gaddafi loyalists, people who are still loyal to the old regime, threats to his life. So while he's proud of it, he's proud of having been there on that day and having found this powerful symbol, he's also a little bit fearful of it.
Gabriel Gatehouse, foreign correspondent for BBC News. Thank you so much, Gabriel.
Always a pleasure.
The earth is shifting under Taiwan. An earthquake over the weekend has complicated efforts to find a political path forward for a nation facing a test of its entire political system. The 6.4 magnitude earthquake struck the island on Saturday, collapsing a 17-story apartment building, killing dozens, trapping more than 100 others, some of whom are believed to be still alive. Authorities have arrested the owner of the collapsed building, and reports by our colleagues at the New York Times say neighbors have expressed concerns about the safety of the building that may go all the way back to regulations imposed when Taiwan was governed by Japan. All of this is a test for President-elect Tsai Ing-wen, who is the island's first female president, swept into office last month in a landslide victory that also saw her party, the Democratic Progressive Party, win a majority in Taiwan's legislature for the first time in history. Bonnie Glazer is director of the China Power Project at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and she says the independence of Taiwan is one issue looming over all of the domestic turmoil for a nation having to both save face and save jobs in competitive East Asia.
The new president in Taiwan, who will be inaugurated on May 20th, Tsai Ing-wen, has been in and out of government in Taiwan. She's had experience as a trade negotiator. She has been in charge of relations with mainland China. She was formerly vice premier and trained as a lawyer in the United States as well as in the UK. She is a very international person, but she also deeply understands the problems that Taiwan faces, its economy, its isolation, and she is very ambitious, very capable. Comes from a party that supports Taiwan independence, but joined the party late, only about a decade ago. She isn't one of the die-hard supporters of Taiwan independence, but I think strongly believes that Taiwan should be autonomous and that the people of Taiwan should decide its future.
Do you get the sense or an inkling of a vision in your encounters with her?
Well, I think that her vision for Taiwan is that it cannot be so dependent, really, on mainland China economically. Right now, Taiwan exports about 40% of its products to mainland China and Macau and Hong Kong. And this economic dependence isn't surprising because of the geographic proximity that Taiwan has and the similarity in culture and the same language, but it creates a vulnerability for Taiwan. So I think that part of Tsai Ing-wen's vision is to diversify markets to Southeast Asia, to India. And then she'd also like to improve relations with Japan and strengthen relations with the United States. But first and foremost, her agenda is really at home. It's to narrow the income gap between the rich and the poor, to create more opportunities for students who are getting out of college, and to improve the environment. She wants to eliminate nuclear power plants, for example, in Taiwan, which is very controversial.
So the domestic issues really rule, at least in the short term. But externally, if we look at Taiwan and China, can anyone say with clarity whether they're moving towards each other or away from each other right now?
Well, I think one thing that we can be certain of, and that is that even though Taiwan is de facto independent, that is, that they elect their own rulers and they make decisions about running their economy, their political system, Taiwan really doesn't have the option today of being de jure independent. And so it can't go very far. It's located 100 miles from the mainland. So I think both sides really do need to continue to find a way to keep that relationship stable and cooperative. The mainland has hoped that this economic integration strategy would lead to political unification, but it doesn't look that way. The trend right now is that more and more people think of themselves as Taiwanese, maybe a combination of both Taiwanese and Chinese, but certainly not solely Chinese.
Is the stability of this relationship dependent on keeping everything so blurry?
Well, I think that ambiguity serves the interests of both sides. Even when the KMT was in power, and they have been in power under President Ma Ying-jeou for the last 8 years, they maintained an ambiguity about whether or not the existence that they both recognized as one China, what that China would be called. That Taiwan has called it the Republic of China. The mainland has called it the People's Republic of China, but they both did accept that there was one China. This is not something that Tsai Ing-wen is likely to accept, although she has been careful not to explicitly reject this notion of one China, and I think she'll continue to be careful in the future. There may come a time where the people of Taiwan decide that they really want to be part of the mainland, but the mainland's going to have to be a very different place.
Bonnie Glaser is director of the China Power Project at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Here in America, a group of Muslim activists wants to counter the notion that moderates in the West are happy to sit quiet as major attacks by Islamic extremists disrupt mixed communities in Paris and San Bernardino. Can moderate Muslims step up to counter the messages of hate espoused by extreme fundamentalists? A group of American Muslims recently announced the creation of a new initiative to do just that. It's called the Muslim Reform Movement. Journalist and activist Asra Nomani is the group's co-founder. Nomani has long been fighting for what she calls a more inclusive Islam. Her early efforts at her hometown mosque in West Virginia are documented in the latest America Reframed series, which begins tonight airing on the World Channel, co-produced by our partner WGBH. Nomani's film is called The Mosque in Morgantown. Nomani says that the second-class status of women in mosques here in the United States can be traced to Saudi Arabia's export of its extremist interpretation of Islam.
2 out of 3 mosques in America separate and segregate women in conditions that are very much separate and unequal. And unfortunately, those barriers are a metaphor for the barriers that they then have with our wider American Muslim community, according to research that's been done on those mosque cultures. And so what we find then is that the mosques become symbolic outposts from this amazing, rich, diverse, beautiful country that we've got here in America. And they do not practice this philosophy that I think is so critical of open hearts and open minds and open doors.
What do you make of criticism like you received from Hazem Bhatta, who is a member of the mosque, who said your loud speech actually causes progress to go in the other direction?
Had she gone about this in the right way, had she gotten the support of the moderate people such as myself, We could have made 10 years progress in 10 months' time. But the way she did it, there was no benefit, and it made everyone look bad.
I have to laugh because Hazem Bhatta said that to me in 2003 when we first went in through the front door and I first wrote about these issues of gender apartheid in our mosques. It is 2016 now. Hazem Bhatta has risen to the highest levels of American Muslim leadership as a leader in the Islamic Society of North America. Guess what? Last year, they put forward a mission statement to make mosques women-friendly. And you know what? I did a tour of mosques here in the Northern Virginia area over the last several weeks, and this is what I got. I got to watch a sermon through a closed-circuit TV. I had to sit behind a curtain where I couldn't look at the prayer leader. I was sent upstairs and put into this darkened space where we couldn't even hear the prayer service appropriately. The conditions of women in mosques in the United States are still second class, and if African Americans were treated this way in any churches in this country, people would be outraged.
Why are the Saudis so persuasive in Muslim communities in the United States with a message that seems so at odds with the kinds of pluralism that America is known for? Is it Saudi's money? Is it something persuasive about the message? And why are sexual segregation issues a symbol of piety, that if you go along with this, then you must be, you know, a true Muslim, whereas if you don't, there's no possibility that you could be?
Yeah, John, it's a great question that you're asking, because it requires us to really peel back the layers on the dynamic that we're confronting today. And we have to do that in order to really understand how to fix the problem. Saudi Arabia has money. It has ideological influence. It claims that it is the custodians of the two holiest mosques in the Muslim world, in Mecca and Medina. So it has this sort of spiritual leverage that it exerts upon Muslims. Every Muslim is required, according to the edicts of Islam, to go on a pilgrimage to Mecca. And guess who controls that visa application? The government of Saudi Arabia. So that has a lot of moral sway among Muslims. And that's why last year, when thousands of Muslims were killed in this stampede that has been just the latest of many irresponsibilities by the government of Saudi Arabia on how it conducts the Hajj, I wrote a petition on change.org to boycott the Hajj. You know, we have to boycott the government of Saudi Arabia and its ideological persuasion among Muslims. It has been a 40-year exportation of the Saudi interpretation called Wahhabism or Salafism that has led to the creation of militant organizations from Al-Qaeda to the Islamic State. We have to be really honest and clear about that. America, unfortunately, has this a relationship with the government of Saudi Arabia, seeing it as a, quote, partner and ally in the war against terrorism. But it is very difficult to turn to Dr. Frankenstein to kill the monster when Dr. Frankenstein is still feeding the monster. And that is the situation that we're in today. And we have to really be very honest about it and stand up with moral courage against this kind of influence so that we can have a world of peace and human rights and secular governance.
That's a pretty provocative statement. Are you calling on all Muslims to boycott the Hajj?
Absolutely. And I would say to them that they would be following in the footsteps of the Prophet Muhammad, because when the Hajj was controlled by the Quraysh tribe that practiced an interpretation of life that the Prophet Muhammad opposed, he said, I will not go on the Hajj as long as it is a land that is being protected by people who practice jahiliyyah, which is ignorance. And I would argue that indeed the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia is practicing jahiliyyah. Who in their right mind believes that it is okay to flog a blogger, Raif Badawi, because of what he wrote? Who in their right mind thinks that it's okay to imprison a poet, Ashraf Fayyad, because he dares to be a romantic poet? Who in their right mind thinks that it is okay to kill gays, that it is okay to kill a maid because she refuses the advances of her Saudi boss? This is a culture of tyranny that we have to oppose, and any Muslim who believes in righteousness must oppose the government of Saudi Arabia.
Asra Nomani, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, John.
Nomani is co-founder of the Muslim Reform Movement and the author of Standing Alone, An American Woman's Struggle for the Soul of Islam. Her film, The Mosque in Morgantown, is part of a series of documentaries that debuts on the World Channel tonight. And here's something to take with you today. Cockroaches. Perhaps only an American would look at a nasty little cockroach and conclude from its compact durability that it might be the perfect design for a useful little robot. The robot wizards at the University of California, Berkeley, Robert Full and his collaborator Kaushik Jayaram, have made a prototype called Cram, a palm-sized robot that mimics roaches and is good at squeezing into really small places. Among the tricks American cockroaches can do, move at 20 body lengths per second, squeeze their bodies into half their original size. Impressive, eh? Dr. Full's little Crambot will possibly be tried as a rescue first responder, finding people trapped by earthquakes or other disasters. Even if it is a ripoff of a cockroach design, you can head over to thetakeaway.org/innovation and nominate it for America's greatest innovation, or you can vote for any of our five finalists. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Staples, offering tech services for small business owners like PC setup and repair. More at staples.com/tech services. Staples, make more happen.
PRI, Public Radio International.